tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 14th of May, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's Thursday once again, which means we are here today to discuss geopolitics with our resident geopolitical analyst, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, thank God. My thyroid medication increase has me 100%, really 110%. But at the same time, I don't know if there's a connection or not, but I am listening to an unhealthy amount of Steely Dan. It really is. It's starting to interfere with day-to-day life. So I'm not going to ask you to call me Dr. Wu or anything like that, but you never know.
I'm not really familiar with Steely Dan. Is that blues music? Is it folk music?
Well, they tend to call it a jazz rock fusion. They don't really have a genre. I like it because of the musicianship. It's just really two guys and a bunch of studio musicians. So their albums in the later part of their existence were extremely polished for the day, for the mid to late 70s. And the lyrics tend to be extremely difficult to interpret, which I also like. But they're a little bit before my time. I remember them as a little kid, but, as a former musician, it's that they're very interesting and they still have a huge fan base today.
Yeah. I've heard of the name before, I've been into most different forms of music. I'm aware of most bands in most sort of genres. As I say, I've heard of Steely Dan before, but I can't recall actually listening to their music. So I will look them up again after this podcast and see what I think, Matt. So thank you for the recommendation. Well, today we're going to be taking a look at Ukraine and Russia again, the problems that we have in Ukraine and the way that Russia is dealing with it. And today we're going to be looking at a particular person within Russia and his thoughts on nuclear weapons, and that is Sergei Karaganov, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he's quite an important person, Matt. Do you want to just let us know a bit of background on this Karaganov?
Well, his education came in the Soviet 1970s. He stayed with the kind of the national Bolshevik anti-Zionist Soviet Union as most Jews left. He vehemently despises Israel. He is half Jewish. But Jews in the West absolutely despise him. He's banned from the EU. He's sanctioned. He has harsh words to say about Israel. But he is very well educated, and he did have the ear of Putin now and again. There are several others who compete with him for that. Putin has a number of people advising him of different backgrounds and different points of view, and he picks the one that he thinks is the best. And he's been kind of sidelined recently, but you never know, he may come back later. That's how Putin is with his advisors.
Well, he seems to be something of a hardliner. When I look him up on Wikipedia, it's just sort of tells you lots of things you're supposed to think are critical about him. Apparently, he's the progenitor of the Karaganov Doctrine, which states that Moscow should pose as the defender of human rights of ethnic Russians living in the near abroad. So basically, look out for the rights of ethnic Russians all around the world. And of course, this is what's happened in Ukraine. Putin has had to go in there because the human rights of the Russians speakers there were being abused. But this guy is also Jewish, so he doesn't really fit the mold of our Jewish elites in the West. He seems to be quite different. So quite interested in what he has to say. But first off, we're going to have a look at something which is happening in Finland. And the author of this is Drago Bosnick, who we've used before. And he's writing for the InfoBricks site, which is an official website information source of the BRICS countries. And he says, on April 23rd, the Finnish government submitted a proposal to the parliament that would allow the import and storage of nuclear weapons on its territory. The document states that the country's cabinet of ministers has proposed amendments to its Atomic Energy Act and Criminal Code. However, the act hides a far more sinister intent, as the Finnish Ministry of Defence clearly stated that, quote, legislative restrictions on the import of nuclear explosives into Finland, as well as on their transport, delivery and storage within its territory, will be removed if such activities are related to Finland's defence, NATO's collective defence or defence cooperation, close quote. Russia cannot simply ignore the deployment of nuclear weapons along its borders, particularly when it comes to increasingly hostile nations such as Finland. Helsinki has been directly involved in the mysterious drone attacks that keep hitting Russian oil refineries and depots, particularly around St. Petersburg. It should be noted that both Poland and the Baltic states are also directly involved in these attacks, as Kiev cannot reach Russian airspace from that direction without the aforementioned countries willingly allowing it. Worse yet, Warsaw itself is now also directly involved in simulating nuclear strikes on both Russia and Belarus. France and Poland are conducting joint drills on precisely such attacks, specifically involving nuclear-capable D-assault Rafale fighters. Worse yet, Paris and Warsaw are reportedly working on a separate nuclear-sharing agreement that would allow the Polish Air Force to equip its F-16s and upcoming F-35s with French nuclear weapons. The latest deployment of Rafales is most likely related to these plans, demonstrating that a new nuclear sharing mechanism is being put in place alongside the existing one. Now, one point that I think we have to bring up here is that Putin has talked about nuclear weapons before, and that the European powers should remind themselves that Russia is actually a nuclear state and that they shouldn't back Ukraine too much. So it could be that this is a response to Putin's mention of nuclear weapons. Or this could be something that's gone on from before. We also know that the treaty between Russia and America on nuclear weapons, that just finished and it didn't get renewed a while or so back. So it does seem as if there's movements to do with these nuclear weapons. But of course, as I say, I think the West would just say, well, this is a response to what Putin has said, and they would use that as their excuse for why they are doing this. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, the defense ministry is headed by a guy named Antti Häkkänen, who's a lawyer without the tiniest shred of military experience or anything like that. It struck me reading this that I remember when they were trying to move nuclear weapons around in the 1980s, there were anti-nuke protests all over Germany, all over Scandinavia, and apparently those don't exist anymore, and I find that very curious. Now, in my book, Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022-2025, I spend a lot of time talking about Poland. There is a faction in the Pentagon who would like to use Poland as another Ukraine, God forbid. But not everybody, of course. None of these countries are even remotely prepared for a war against Russia. You know, Finland was neutral for a long time. Plenty of Russians lived there. I think the U.S. gave them all kinds of financial incentives to come out of their shell. And they're clear, they're a combatant nation. Now, as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, it's the West that brought nuclear weapons to Russia's border all over the place. And that's where, and I have this little piece of an article that you just read before the Kataganov article, because it makes sense out of what he's saying. He's not saying this out of nowhere. So, and, you know, these countries really can't afford these weapons. You know, the Rafael fighters are new, or relatively new, at least the ones that they want are new. You know, all this money is being, because Ukraine has clearly lost, the war is largely over from the Ukrainian point of view. So now the U.S. and NATO are just trying to find someone else to carry on with, so absolutely obsessed with doing damage to Russia. You know, Ukraine is simply just out of men. And you know, trained men anyway. And so is the West, who started talking about nuclear weapons. And it's precisely that that Kiriganov is talking about. And it's because of his article. This is a bit, what we have here is a small piece of a much longer article he has on the nuclear doctrine. Putin does not agree necessarily at this point. I'm not sure where I stand on it. I tend to agree with the guy, at least as a threat. He is certainly a Russian nationalist of a type, of the old Soviet type. Violently anti-Zionist and anti-European. Anti-European in the sense of, you know, what's happened to the EU in the last, you know, 50 years. Trying to make Poland into the next Ukraine just makes me very sad. They can't put them in the line of fire. It's going to be another slaughter of the Slavic nation. I can't imagine. I talk about this in my book. I don't mention the Finnish part at all, but I do mention, I have several chapters dedicated to Poland. And once Ukraine runs out of men, they're going to go to Poland. And I hope that there's some common sense there in their military. I know there is with certain generals. I talk about that, where they say, we can't go up against Russia's military. Even at our best, we can't go up against Russia's military. Russia's military is a premier military of the world. They're in the millions. They're battle-hardened. Their technology is superior to anything in the West. We have no chance. It's going to be another mass slaughter. But this is what the EU has become. Kadyrov said, the EU has gone mad. The Israelis have gone mad. He uses this phrase all the time. It's like, we can't expect rationality from these people. Hence, nuclear weapons has to be put on the table.
Well, up until now, it's always been seen as beyond the pale. That's why they haven't been moving nuclear weapons around. It's like they're there as a deterrent, and that's it. There hasn't been any actual talk of using them, well, until now. So let's have a look at Kiriganov's article. The current stage of the West's war against Russia may be ending, but it lasted longer than it should have. Russia has so far lacked the decisiveness needed for active nuclear deterrence, the only solution to the European problem that again threatens us. But the special military operation has stimulated Russia's development. Russia has roused itself. Patriotism and national pride have increased immensely. The value of serving the motherland has been recognized. The people are displaying their best qualities. The economy and scientific research have revived. The most important professions, engineers, scientists, officers, skilled workers, medics, and teachers, have finally been recognized as such. Drawing the West's fire upon ourselves, we have used it to undermine the comprador bourgeoisie and its servants in the intelligentsia. Portuguese colonialists coined the term comprador in reference to local traders who worked for them. Due to the reforms of the 1990s, we allowed this sector to reach unhealthy proportions. It is good that the process of cleansing Russia has been launched by the SMO without harsh repressions. Regrettably, the incipient societal and economic recovery has come at the cost of the lives of tens of thousands of valiant warriors. To them, eternal gratitude and remembrance. And if, or rather when, the unfinished war resumes, we must not allow such sacrifices again. In 2013, I warned, much more sternly than before, a group of European leaders that dragging Ukraine into the European Union and NATO would lead to war and millions dead. I clearly remember how they dared not look me in the eyes, instead staring at the floor, and then resumed prattling on about the benefits of expanding the area of democracy, trust, and human rights. They wanted another 40 million white slaves, which they partly got in the form of several million Ukrainian refugees. They spoke of the need to contain Russia, even though it was still quite accommodating at the time. Unfortunately, our response to NATO's 2011 aggression in Libya was muffled, so now we are paying for the long years of appeasement, our attempts to please them, and the comprador nature of part of our elite. By reincorporating Crimea in 2014 and sending troops to Syria in 2015, we temporarily retarded the EU's military adventurism, but then we carelessly relaxed. If our ultimatum for an end to NATO expansion had been made in 2018-2020 and backed up with strengthened nuclear deterrence, the current war could have been avoided, or at least it would have been much less bloody and lengthy. 2022 revealed that the West and the Ukrainian junta had been intensively preparing for war. So what he appears to be saying here is, if they had used this nuclear deterrent a couple of years back, we wouldn't have had all this war dead. You wouldn't have had all these dead Ukrainians. You wouldn't have had all these dead Russians. But the problem is, you might then have got a retaliation from Europe, and you could have ended up with a much worse situation. I mean, that would be my thoughts on this, Matt, is that if Russia had, you know, used their nuclear deterrent, there would have been a response. There would have been a nuclear response. I'm not sure that it would have just stopped there, and it would have saved all these Russians and Ukrainians dying. And what are your thoughts on this?
It's interesting you bring it up, because Kataganov said that there would be no Israeli invasion of Lebanon if Iran had nuclear weapons. The possession of nuclear weapons, you know, leads to other countries being very polite. On the other hand, Putin's response to, of course, Putin always listens to him. He respects him, doesn't necessarily go along with him. But his response, a number of others around him, is that you're assuming the West functions as a rational actor. And they don't. They're quite willing to go head-to-head with Russia with nuclear weapons. They simply don't care. That the sheer number of, 2 million dead Ukrainians, they don't give a damn about that, and they want more. Dragging Poland into this, dragging Finland into this, even Romania. The level of propaganda, the fact that most Russian media in the EU has been banned, regardless of their point of view. You're not dealing with a rational actor. It's more like a dying regime using this as a way somehow to hold on to power. And of course, the war in Ukraine is long lost. So then the next step is, how can we keep it going? So clearly, as far as nuclear weapons go, and Putin's almost exact words was, you underestimate the insanity or even the tenacity of the West in dealing with this issue. I think maybe the opposition to the war would have been more substantial if Russia had the active nuclear deterrence there. However, on the positive side, this has been going on for some time, especially after the sanctions were imposed. Sanctions, and he agrees with this fully, that patriotism, nationalism have increased immensely in Russia. The scientific establishment connected to the military-industrial complex or not has gone through the roof. Unfortunately, Ukraine doesn't have one anymore. Of course, despite the fact that Putin has purged Russia of the comprador bourgeoisie, those are millionaires and billionaires that are dependent on Western contacts to function. As many of them, he's exiled or thrown in prison. There's always going to be a few more. There's always a pro-Western faction in the banking system of the Kremlin. You can't get rid of every single one of them. They're always going to be there. And that just seems to be a pro-Western group. And even though they may dress it up as Russian patriotism, they're still a destructive element. Kadyrov actually wants to start populating Siberia, making that the center of Russia rather than the present European part of Russia. He's making it the capital of Russia just to draw it away from Europe, a Europe that's dying financially, that's losing population massively, and that's willing to go this far to do damage to a Russia that has never at any time or at any point threatened it. And I mentioned the lack of the anti-nuke protesters in the sense that the anti-nuke protesters of the 80s were created by the regime. They're artificial because they're nowhere to be found now. You have formerly neutral nations. They're trying to get Switzerland to do this. Bringing nuclear weapons in from the U.S. without a peep of protest from a defense minister that doesn't know anything about military life or military stuff at all. He's a lawyer and a politician. Actually, in my book, come to think of it, I go through a lot of the EU's defense ministers who are either women or men who are just absolutely – they have no connection to the military life at all. And they're making decisions. It's – you know, in Russia, it's okay. In Russia, it's legal to have uniformed officers as cabinet ministers. It's not so much the case in the U.S. and in Europe. So politicians are making military decisions rather than military men. So maybe the West would have taken the nuclear deterrent option as a challenge that they could match. But I think at a minimum, the opposition to the war in the U.S. Would have in Europe would have increased because of the nuclear issue. I think that's the one issue that draws people's attention. I don't think I hate these headlines. We're heading to World War III. They've been saying that for decades. That's just, clickbait stuff. That is nowhere near what's going on now. But is it possible? Well, I mean, I know that there's elites in the West that hold this view that losing a few cities is worth it if we kill a few more Russians. And I talk about that to some extent. We've talked about that together. Even before you got out, I had a few episodes on that absurd irrationality. And it's, Putin's a statesman. He's a normal guy. And it took him a while to wrap his head around the fact that he's not dealing with a normal enemy. They're not, they're not rational actors. It's more like a wounded animal backed into a corner. They'll do anything to do damage, to say anything, believe anything, to do even minor damage to Russia. All that the West is doing now is committing acts of terrorism. They're going after civilian centers. I mean, Ukraine via the U.S. has been doing that for a while now. They've lost the war. So what do they do now? They're kill as many Russian civilians as possible. Terrorism is an official policy. It's normal. It's been normalized with the U.S. And so Putin is doing things he never wanted to do, like using heavy weaponry, especially the heavier missiles, to hit places like Kiev and Odessa. He never wanted to do that. Knock out the power. Those things were built by Russia in the first place. That was totally, his purpose, this invasion, was to preempt a massive Ukrainian invasion of the Donbas. You had a massive army that was gathering in February of that year. And he knew that if they would have invaded, there would have been a mass genocide. Russia would have had to intervene anyway. And all of this, here you have like a third world country, which Ukraine has become, and all their money is being diverted to building an army and a navy and an air force that was mostly destroyed on the ground in the first month of the war. Pilots going up there with minimal training, getting knocked out of the sky immediately. The shiny metal caskets that they're getting from the West, they simply don't care. And I don't want to get into the Nukazadia idea, but the invasion also eliminated the idea of building that entity in Crimea or Odessa, Odessa. And but for some reason, Zelensky has kicked Oleg Kolomoisky out of the country, which is a whole completely separate issue. But Putin says, you know, you're thinking like a rational guy here. We're not dealing with a rational enemy. And that's what it comes down to.
I find it interesting. It pointed out there about the fact that there's been an increase in patriotism and love for the motherland and people wanting to go out and fight for their country. I mean, we were told that if we put sanctions on Russia, everybody would turn against Putin. Exactly the same as we were told, oh, if we start bombing Iran, they'll all turn against the mullahs. And the complete opposite happens. When you start attacking another country, then they forget their petty arguments and they all come together to resist and defend their people against the attack. That's the way that it happens. So I find it very believable that he says that there's been an increase in patriotism and love for the motherland, because that's what I would predict is happening. Yet we're constantly told that that is not what happens on the mainstream media. Getting back to the quotes here, there are many people in Ukraine, primarily in its eastern and southern regions, whom we can call a kindred people. But the core of the Ukrainian population, mainly to the west of the Dnieper, is a different people. They have a different history, different cultural codes, and a strong anti-Russian orientation that was cultivated by the Austro-Hungarians, Poles, and other Western countries. Russia requires reasonable isolation from the Ukrainian and European maladies and should chart and follow an independent path of healthy and sound development. Today we are winning the war, but continue to provide muffled responses to open aggression like piratical seizures of our ships, threats to close straits, attempts to organise an economic blockade, strikes on oil terminals, and attacks with the encouragement or at least covert support of the Euro elite on our oil tankers. We respond to these and similar provocations and to attacks on our cities with intensified bombardment of targets in Ukraine. But this will not solve the problem. Ukraine was deliberately thrown into the fire of war so that the flames would burn us. Ukraine's people are of no consequence to the Europeans, and the war will continue with greater or lesser intensity until the elimination of its source and the source of other conflicts, the European elite, which is degrading intellectually, morally, and materially. In a bid to prevent the inevitable collapse of the beneficial status quo to which they are accustomed, they are fomenting war on the subcontinent, refusing to understand that they risk its destruction. We have not yet destroyed, as we did in 1812 to 1815, and 1941 to 1945, the hostile coalition facing us, nor broken its will to aggression. The fight has entered its intermediate stage. The Western-backed remnants of Ukraine will continue to generate instability and terrorism, if a bit less intensively. The economic war against us will not stop. Europe is preparing for a new clash, and will probably use, not necessarily using Kiev, the remnants of the Ukrainian army reinforced and re-equipped, along with forces from Europe's poorer countries. Russia will have to respond militarily to the inevitable provocations and breaches of any agreements. In reality, open aggression against us will likely resume. Most sanctions will remain in place, but Russia's strategy in that war should differ from how Moscow is waging the present one. The continued American withdrawal from Europe and total exit from the conflict should be facilitated through fierce deterrence and through the destruction of Europe's elite, who grasp at their fading power by inciting hostility towards Russia, fooling their own people, and escalating the conflict. So this is really sort of talking about things from the other side from what we're seeing on the mainstream media here, talking about these attacks on oil tankers, attacks on infrastructure, terrorism, and how Russia is being incredibly restrained and hasn't actually responded to that other than to bombard Ukraine, even though they know that it's, you know, this is all being facilitated by Europe and America. And I do find it interesting that Trump at the moment is talking about pulling out American troops from Germany. So this removing America from Europe, I mean, it might happen through a different mechanism. It might happen because Trump removes these troops because he thinks that Europe aren't paying for them. He doesn't really seem to understand that they're there as an occupying force, is how they're seen by a lot of people, but particularly Germans. So it could be that American bases could get shut down and moved out anyway because of Trump might put things in a mechanism in place to do that because he's not happy with NATO anymore. So it might not actually come down to Russia having to physically fight to actually get rid of those bases. It might just happen naturally. Anyway, what are your thoughts on this, Matt?
Well, the last bit that you said there has been Putin's point of view for a long time. He's aware of how wrecked the European economies are. You know, Belgium's debt, I think, is 350% of its GDP. That they're lying about their unemployment figures, that they're much higher than stated. And, you know, I mean, this is a few years ago, you know, waiting for them to collapse. He's well aware that NATO is in no position, even with American assistance, to take on the Russian military. But without it, NATO is, you know, to put it mildly, a paper tiger. Zero combat experience. And if you read, again, I don't want to keep plugging my book, but if you read my book, I go into great detail about German equipment over the last 5 years that has been of extremely low quality. The Swedish, German products, you know, the Puma fighting vehicle, all of these are pieces of garbage. Whatever happened to German engineering? They're in no position to take on Belarus, let alone Belarus and Russia. And, you know, Putin is using, you know, Russia is using maybe 15% of its military power at any given time with this war. Of course, Ukraine is using, you know, 150%, and an additional 50% is from foreigners. It's foreigners now who are doing any fighting at the front. They're drafting women, apparently. They're drafting those with mental deficiencies and drug addicts. Anybody who's within the age range, minimal training, and gets sent to the front to be vaporized. There's a reason why the Ukrainian desertion is so high, out of control, and why Putin has made it. He's streamlined the method of gaining a Russian passport for them who want to desert to the east. This is and you know, he's right to a great extent. Crimea and Syria, yeah, that frightened the West a little bit. You know, they won in both of those cases. No, no, they only won, but in the Crimean case, their standard of living went through the roof. Nobody, even if you don't like the Russians, nobody wants to be a part of that third world backwater of Ukraine anymore. The only economy it has is from foreign aid. The currency is worthless. It's backed up by Western power and absolutely nothing else. Ukraine produces nothing that the West can't produce for itself. Its future would have been to do what Belarus does, to be an independent country in a brotherly relationship with Russia, Belarus, and plug into the Eastern economic world, which is far better off than the Western. That would have been there, and they were geared towards that anyway. No one really wanted a repeat of the 1990s, but who caused that? Russians didn't cause that. That's from Western economic ideologies. Every Ukrainian there is well aware that they're ruled by a tiny handful of Jewish oligarchs, and Kadyrov is not shy about talking about that. Now, you know, I have another book out simply called Ukrainian Nationalism, and I make a very similar argument to what he's saying here. Now, the eastern southern regions, you know, they speak Russian. This is why Putin had absolutely no incentive to hurt civilians. That's why he moved so slowly here. But much of the rest, the Western, the right bank of the Dnieper, as we say, they're not a radically different people, but they are a different people. Now, they don't necessarily have an anti-Russian orientation, at least prior to the war. But they, the propaganda, God knows what they've done now. But they certainly don't want to be drafted. They don't want to fight for this government. Zelensky's presidential powers ran out 2 years ago. He can't have an election. I mean, the rigging to get him reelected would have to be so severe as to be almost hilarious. And even then, he still might not win. He is so immensely unpopular. I've said 1,000 times, this started when I was on my honeymoon. Of course, stuff always happens when I'm away. I came back and I said, the war should have been over by now. So much of the Ukrainian forces were destroyed very early on. The Air Force destroyed on the ground. A normal country would have entered in negotiations for a conditional surrender, which they were doing in Istanbul. But the British and the Americans said, you're not going to do that. And we're going to drag this war out. Now, when he talks about not giving a damn about Ukrainian bodies, he's absolutely right. And he's saying more here, being half Jewish, he is talking about the Shabbat organization who loves the idea of dead Slavs. Remember, Ukraine to the Jew is a land of the Cossacks, the uprisings of Khmelnytsky and the Haidamak uprising, which were very hard on the Jews, as they should have been. They do not care about, so much of Jewish policy requires, New Khazaria requires a depopulation of Ukraine. They simply don't care. They win either way here. The elite in Kiev live entirely by asset strip. There's no asset strip anymore. So now they live stealing Western aid. But because they're useful against Russia, the Americans look the other way. For years and years and years, the IMF has been forwarding money to this country, knowing that they're never going to see it again in the billions of euros or dollars. They're never going to see it again. It's not going to be used, for anything. And yet they keep doing it. And I wondered, back on my old website, the American Journal of Russian and Slavic Studies, I'm going, why? Why is this the case? And what we're finding out, the West occupies much of Ukrainian land now, or the Western corporations do. And so they can't use that anymore. They have nothing of value left, economically speaking, to take. There's no state assets to privatize anymore left. So the only thing they have left is blood, the blood of Ukrainian men. And it's all men, by the way. Although recently, they don't care, they're dragging women and even girls. These videos, I know you've seen it, a lot of our listeners have seen these videos of the forced drafting. What kind of morale must there be? It's a punishment. Either you get punished in Ukraine by either going to jail or getting drafted, because what's going to happen to you. This is, at this point, the war should have been over in the summer of 22. No different really than Georgia in 08. But Georgia didn't have this insanity, this obsession of the Western world to do damage to what they consider a rival who was thriving on an illiberal basis, non-liberal basis, that had thrown out the IMF and the World Bank, that went their own way. But now, sanctions, initially it bothered them, but the good news is, and he's already, Karaganov said this, you quoted him here, that they just built their own economy. And the fear is that if sanctions are lifted, like the oil sanctions, for example, that there's still enough of a Western faction in Russian life that they'll try to plug back into Western Europe, which would be a disaster. Russia has been thriving under sanctions because they've just rebuilt and increased trade ties with China and India and Pakistan and everywhere. Russia is very easy to do, and they're trustworthy, unlike the West. The Americans break every treaty they've ever been a part of. The Russians aren't like that. The Russians are big in West Africa. We talked about that. Maybe you weren't out yet, but I spent a lot of time talking about the Russian presence in West Africa, huge pro-Russian military governments in places like Mali and elsewhere. And I was talking about Niger back then. Niger has quite a bit of uranium. And so that was a big deal. You know, I almost fear the lifting of sanctions. Russia has been able, kind of like South Africa did in the 70s and 80s, Russia simply rebuilt all of these institutions on its own foundation. And I fear that if sanctions are lifted, something terrible would happen, that they would go right back to the West again. And this is what Kataganov is talking about here. He fears the same thing. And because there's so much ignorance, I mean, just pure ignorance in the halls of power, they never considered this. They think that everything is like Latin America, where Latin America can be damaged badly by sanctions because they're so dependent on the U.S. Not the case here. Russia is one of the few countries in the world that can be autarkic, that can be entirely self-contained. The other one is the U.S. I think probably the only two countries that could do that. Russia's trade internally is maybe only 10% oil. Externally, it's a different story. You know, and it has destroyed the German economy and hence the Polish economy that it had colonized. So he's right about so much of this. And this is probably the first time I've heard of a major Putin advisor talking about Ukraine as being really two different places. It's a very artificial country. Don't forget, the Donbas is now officially a part of Russia. You know, the Eastern Republics don't exist anymore. They're a part of Russia officially, as far as Russians are concerned. Which that means that their standard of living, just like Crimea, has gone through the roof too. Using the ruble, just using the ruble alone. And damaged parts of it. You have Chinese investment coming in. God, you have Chinese investment coming into parts of Iran right now to help rebuild. But you know, Putin's response as far as the attacks on oil tankers and things, I know, you know, one of my favorite authors, Paul Craig Roberts, is very, very hard on Putin here. I'm not sure what he wants him to do. Kataganov advocates pushing the nuclear option. And, you know, part of me agrees with him, especially at this point. And as I said before, he's not dealing with a rational actor. He's dealing with irrational people. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, I think, you know, with nuclear weapons, a point must come where you have to threaten using them. And you can't just have them as a deterrent the whole time. A point has to come where you have to threaten to use them to put a stop to something. Right. Otherwise, it's like a paper tiger, isn't it? If they haven't actually used it as a threat to try and stop anything, so I can understand it from that point of view. Did you want to say any more on that, Matt, or shall I get back to the quotes?
No, let's get back to the quotes.
Okay, the European elite can be stopped only by demonstrating our actual readiness to conduct initially conventional strikes against the control centres, critical infrastructure and military bases of those European countries that play a key role in preparing and executing military operations against Russia. Priority targets should also include the places where the elites, including of nuclear powers, live and work. Let their capitals finally sober up. If conventional strikes have no effect and Europe does not capitulate or at least retreat, we should be fully prepared militarily and most importantly politically and psychologically to launch limited but sufficient for political effect retaliatory strikes with strategic nuclear weapons. Our non-strategic and strategic nuclear forces should be developed accordingly. Naturally, nuclear strikes should be preceded by several volleys of conventional tactical missiles. Even during the Biden administration, the US received and understood Russia's signals that the war in Ukraine risks nuclear escalation, including attacks on American bases. Now the Americans are trying to wash their hands of the conflict. Trump has offered seemingly peaceful solutions. These are worth trying to give peace the chance to heal the wounds inflicted by the long war. So he's not really saying that they should go move straight to the nuclear weapons. I mean, first off, he's saying that there should be tactical strikes of other weaponry targeted at Europe, effectively at European cities. And of course, it's this is the reason why Europe responds to that, I guess, and says, well, we need to strengthen NATO. Our countries all need to join up with NATO, because here are leading talking heads in Russia that are suggesting that European cities should be attacked and bombed. So we've got no choice but to strengthen NATO and to beef up our armies. Do you see what I mean, Matt? The response to this is the very thing that Russia has used as its reason for why it had to go to Ukraine in the first place, is because they kept, Ukraine wanted to join NATO. NATO kept expanding. And yet these talking heads in Russia will say, well, we need to attack these European cities to put a stop to this, to put a stop to them facilitating Ukraine's terrorism attacks on us. And then Europe's response to that is well, we need to strengthen NATO. We need to beef up our own armed forces. So it's a never ending circle. It's a never ending cycle, basically, very hard to get away from. So I'm not so certain that, maybe I'm wrong here, but I'm getting the idea that you are sort of partially agreeing with the sentiments of this Karaganov. But I think the end result of it is that you just end up with a continuous cycle of building up more and more weaponry and then attacking one another, which I think is a great shame. What are your thoughts on this, Matt?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been reading him for a long time now. The nuclear stuff has gotten him, saying he's not allowed in the EU and all this kind of thing. I'm sure he's crushed by that. But if nothing else works, and I think this is actually his position, if nothing else works, NATO is attacking Russian cities. Russia then has every right in the world to attack European cities. But they want to keep it, just like the Iranians did, they want to keep it entirely to military bases and things like that. But if that doesn't work, they can go to more, significant, power stations and things like that in Germany and elsewhere. But what if that doesn't work? And the terrorism continues. They're out of options then, except for the nuclear doctrine. Now, Putin has to get on television and say, here's where we are right now. Here's why, we're bringing nuclear missiles to the border. Here's why. Problem is, pro-Russian things are so sanctioned in the EU, I don't know if anyone could hear it. All they're hearing is half the story. And that's a huge part of this. Europeans think they know what's going on, but they're only hearing, it's like hearing one half of a phone conversation, not hearing the other person. That's how severe the censorship is. You know a thing or two about censorship. Nothing, if he gets on television and says, this is what we're going to do here. You guys need to stop and that they don't stop. Well, whose fault is that? And what percentage of the population would agree with Putin in this case? I mean, how long do they have to tolerate the NATO's attack on its civilian centers? And all of this, and all of this for very little. What is, the Russians have done nothing to threaten the European Union or NATO. There's no expansionist tendencies. There's not a single person in the Russian government ever wanted any kind of expansionism or anything like that. The EU does. The Americans do, the Israelis do, but not the Russians. So they really can't give you any good reason why all of this is going on. But as far as your typical, even educated person in Germany, he's only hearing half the story. Would they censor Putin's TV address on nuclear weapons? That would be a huge problem. I have the feeling they would, or they would. The newspapers would come out, Die Welt would come out and say, "Here's what Putin said." And they would totally distort it. But if he was able to, you know, reach your typical European individual through you know, television or something, using some platform, I think the Europeans would say, okay, end this war. Stop it. You are hitting Russian civilian centers. You've been doing it for a long time. You're killing Russians. And, of course, the Chinese would support Russia entirely at this point because they know that they're next. So Putin has to, you know, put out his position on the use of nuclear weapons. Right now, he does not agree with this. But maybe at some point, he's not going to have a choice. He's not going to have an option. And you add to that the fact that the West is bringing nuclear weapons to Russia's border all throughout Central Europe. All of these, the jets that Bosnitz was talking about are all capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The Finland thing is just a disaster. You know, bringing U.S. nuclear weapons into Finland. Why would that be? So I stand to my initial position that at a minimum, it would create more rational opposition to the war in the West. But whether that opposition would have anything to do with policy, that's a separate issue.
Well, I think you're right. They would censor him. They would say, oh, this is disinformation. We'll tell you what Putin said. And they'll give you a few lines from his address. And they'll say that the rest of it is disinformation because he'd be talking about attacks on civilians in Russia. You know, you just know that would happen. One thing I've always found interesting about this war is that straight away, Russian news sources were banned completely from the European Union and from Britain. We can't get Russia Today in Britain anymore. And yet there was no banning of the BBC in Russia. We still have BBC correspondents that are in Russia, providing a very warped view of what's going on there and a heavily, heavily censored view. But Russia didn't ban the BBC. Russia didn't ban foreign journalists from Russia in the same way that the European Union banned all the Russian news sources. So I think that is telling in itself. Getting back to the article here, Russia can try to establish limited economic cooperation with the Americans, where it is obviously beneficial, but without any illusion that this promotes peace. Contrary to the myths of naive Marxists and their intellectual siblings, the liberal economists, economic interests are secondary in determining national policy. In serious confrontations, especially war, they inevitably yield to geopolitical, military, strategic, and ideological considerations. Trump's peace proposals are not aimed at lasting peace. If I were the American president, what would I do? Clearly, in maintaining a slow, simmering conflict that weakens Russia and distracts it from internal development and from greater Eurasia, especially China. The Russo-Chinese alliance is already a prevailing force in the world. I would also play on residual pro-Western and pro-European sentiment in the Russian elite and society to prevent Russia from becoming an intellectually, spiritually, and economically sovereign country. Russia cannot allow ourselves to get bogged down in an endless conflict, similar to but worse than the Israeli-Palestinian one. Our past mistake must be quickly corrected by drastically increasing our reliance on nuclear deterrence in Europe. Its elites must be not only contained, but intimidated. At present, they only give the appearance of fearing us, so as to build up their military strength. But they should actually fear us. They should understand that escalating or even continuing the conflict risks their immediate physical destruction, and that a military build-up is pointless, as it will entail an obliterating nuclear response. Our previous restraint in using nuclear weapons has proved maliciously counterproductive, playing into the hands of those who fan militaristic hysteria and Russophobia and who prepare for war. Restraint also amounts to a great power's evasion of its responsibility to prevent conflicts that could potentially escalate into a humanity-ending Third World War. Caution now borders on irresponsibility. Russia should amend our military doctrine to mandate the use of nuclear weapons in any war unleashed by a powerful enemy. it is high time to abandon the Gorbachev-Reagan era view that, quote, there can be no winner in a nuclear war, close quote, which contradicts all military logic and has led, among other things, to NATO's present war against Russia. Of course, I'm not calling for a nuclear war. Even if it was victorious, it would be a great sin. But we must be fully prepared for it so that inaction and indecision do not lead to the crime of continuing a military campaign that is exhausting our country and our people. Such a crime would be a sin even less forgivable. And more importantly, it would be a mistake. Well, I think it's important that we hear stuff like this, that we learn what is being talked about in Russia and their view on what is going on in this war, because we're certainly not going to hear that from the mainstream media. And he does raise a lot of good points there. As I say, I think it would just result in the same situation occurring as what caused all this war in the first place, though, because Europe would then have to build up its nuclear deterrent, build up its military forces. It would want to make NATO stronger. And these are all the reasons why Russia went into Ukraine anyway, is because NATO was trying to expand and take Ukraine in. So I do see it as an endless military cycle, unfortunately. But it's good that we learn about these things. Matt, what are your final thoughts on this today?
Well, as everyone knows, I've been specializing in Russo-Ukrainian affairs in history and politics for, you know, most of my adult life. And the utter ignorance, you know, the Western elite, you know, the regime, they don't study Russia. They invent Russia. They invent an enemy. You know, they write fiction about it, and they come to actually believe it's true. And that's what governs their behavior. Yeah, it's not economic. They don't care. They're already, you know, billionaires. It is ideological. And, you know, part of that is, you know, pursuing Jewish interests. And he's saying that, you know, under the, not blatantly, but he's definitely saying it, between the lines. Yeah, NATO is incapable of taking on the Russian military. For them even to mobilize on the Russian border would take a long time. Maybe they can get, I mean, how many men do you need for an invasion of Russia? They could maybe get, you know, 200,000 at most, you know, men who have no combat experience on the Russian border. Of course, Russia is not going to sit there while that happens. You know, run by defense ministers who have no conception of military life. No one has combat experience there. That's probably it. But what he's saying is that why should we lose another Russian boy, another Russian man, if the nuclear option is there? That I do talk about in my book, not with the nuclear option, but the idea that NATO could never come up with enough men to produce any kind of invasion force, or even replace the Ukrainian military. They simply don't have that capacity. And they don't have that capacity because the U.S. has been financing everything. This is why you have all these female defense ministers. But why give a damn when the U.S. is going to take care of all of this? I mean, Iceland doesn't even have an army. They're a member of NATO, though. Why even worry about it when the U.S. is going to do the bulk of the fighting and the bulk of the financing? So Trump is saying, you know what, that's not going to be the case anymore. And now the Europeans, with terrible economies, on the verge of collapse, especially Germany, high inflation, or the migrant invasion, all this stuff, deindustrialization, and now they're expected to produce an army that could take on the premier military in the world. You know, at some point, there's got to be military men, especially generals. They don't want to send their own men to certain death. And it still shocks me about Ukrainian generals, how they keep doing this and not, you know, getting rid of Zelensky and taking over. You know, the Pentagon has always been like, we're not going to send our boys to an almost certain death. You know, they were a young officer at one point. You know, they do care for their men. And that would be the case in Europe as well. We don't think these guys are going to be slaughtered. And frankly, they don't have the capacity. They don't have the materiel. to build a substantial a force against Russia. And actually, I quoted Bosnich quite a bit in my book in that regard. So, you know, maybe the nuclear options just would be in addition to this fact. But his position is, well, why should, even if they were able to put up, like, say, 300,000 men, which is hard to believe, on the Russian border. Now, of course, you can't hit them directly with nuclear weapons on the border. That might be a problem in and of itself. But, you know, Russia's not going to stand still as they're building up, just like they didn't stand still as the Ukrainians were building up. You know, that there would be a preemptive use of these weapons or a preemptive attack to get rid of this buildup before it got too large. And I just, I just don't see the European Union having that capacity. I'm sorry, NATO having that capacity at all. So the nuclear option, his argument for nuclear, the nuclear option really concerns terrorism against Russia, not the idea of any kind of NATO invasion of Russian territory or replacing the Ukrainian army. I can't imagine. You know, NATO is broke. They have no real leadership. They've given everything away. You know, how many Patriot batteries are left in the world? And they weren't very good to begin with. Russian tanks, Russian jets, everything is far superior to everything, anything that the West can throw against it. And we know that because it was used in Ukraine. So I understand his point. I understand his point of view. And he says it would be a terrible sin because he knows that a lot of innocent people would be killed. He doesn't like it. This war should have been over years ago. And he says that. This war should have been over years ago, but you're dealing with irrational people who, as Lindsey Graham once said, was killing more Russians, keeping Russia from even growing even stronger economically. That they couldn't handle as the West, you know, collapses into third worldization. And that's my final thought on the matter.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.